In all, the Archdiocese mediated 13 cases through Jacobs, 11 women and 2 men. A trail of abuse at least some of these survivors are happy to finally see come out.
I want everyone to know what happened so that it doesn't happen again.
He said to me, if you tell anyone, I'm going to shoot you. Case closed. There's Maskell.
Teresa Lancaster says she was abused by Maskell when she was in high school. She was one of 2 women who filed a $40 million lawsuit against him and the Archdiocese of Baltimore more than 20 years ago. The suit was thrown out because the statute of limitations had passed. She hopes the renewed public interest in the online petition will put pressure on the church to make the priest's file public.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is your host, Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler. And with me today is...
Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
And today, Lisa and I have a very special guest.
My name is Joelle Castex, and I am an author and speaker, and I'm one of the leading advocates for adult victims of child sexual abuse, mostly within institutions like the Catholic Church.
Well, thank you very much, Joelle, for coming on Real Crime Profile. We really appreciate it. And thank you even more for being an advocate for victims of child sexual victimization. And we just finished talking about the second episode of The Keepers on Netflix. Have you seen that series?
Yes, I have. And I know a lot of the people who are involved in it. And
really?
And The Keepers is basically what I do. I'm a survivor of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. And
so am I, just so you know.
And so what I do is very much like what the women who were trying to figure out what happened to Sister Kathy have done, except what I do is on a much larger scale and much more deeply involved in this civil justice system.
Well, that's great. And believe me, we're going to have a lot of questions for you about that. And just so we can put this into context, the John Jay Catholic Church priest abuse study covered the time period between 1950 and 2000. And they identified roughly 3,000 priest offenders and over 10,000 child victims during that time period. They discovered that the average delay in reporting by a child was 20 years, and that 25% delayed after 30 years, delayed disclosure until 30 years after the events. So we don't even know the accurate number of how many children were victimized by Catholic priests during that time period, because 2030 will be sort of the time when most victims will have come forward, if they're based on the same time scale. So we're still hearing day after day, week after week, year after year of additional victims. Has that been your experience, Joelle?
Yes, and those of us in the industry, so to speak, don't really take the John Jay study seriously. And that's because it's self-reporting. The bishops reported themselves what they had. And we're finding in the data that we have collected, those of us who work within civil justice, those of us who have collected data from lawsuits, media reports, victims who've come forward who have not been able to use the civil or criminal justice system, that is vastly underreported.
Right.
So,
right. Yeah. So I wasn't suggesting that they were accurate numbers. I was suggesting that the numbers are much greater. And as you said, those are only the numbers that were reported within the Catholic Church. They were the tip of the iceberg. They were not the entirety of all cases that have occurred.
Correct. And to go to the second part of your question, about that we're not even seeing the tail end of the crisis. What we're finding is that the church told us that the peak of abuse was going to happen in the 80s. And what we're finding is because of this delayed reporting, this 20 to 30 year lag from the time that the abuse happens to when the victim comes forward, is that we see this bell curve. So the abuse happens and the victim comes forward 20 years later. So we see this bell curve in reporting, and it's a moving bell curve. So we always see this peak of abuse happening about 20 years. So it's a moving bell curve.
Right.
And I think we're always going to see this moving bell curve peak of abuse. And 20 years from now, we're still going to see it. We see, big smatterings of abuse reporting in places like Australia, where it's huge right now because they had this Royal Commission that the government there sponsored this amazing, similar to our what would be a Senate hearing here, but with far more power to subpoena people. And that really empowered victims to come forward.
That's great.
Guam is a hotbed for reporting right now. We're seeing scandals break out all over the world. And even here in the mainland United States, we're seeing pockets of abuse reporting pop up all over. And I think that the cover-up conspiracy is still going on, but it's far more pernicious. And it will really only be exposed for its real horrific nature of what it has done when we change the criminal and civil laws. But
right.
I think that truly it is still going on, and we'll still see this cover up for the next 30 years, 40 years, and we'll still see victims coming forward.
More pernicious? How could it be? I mean, after watching The Keepers, I can't. I mean, can you explain that and unpack that a little bit, how it's even more pernicious?
Well, in The Keepers, and I don't mean to be, I don't want to, spoiler alert, I don't want to do that because I don't remember what part exposed what. But, you see in a lot of places in Maryland, and we saw it in Delaware, we've seen it. I've done work in Alaska, I've done work on Guam, I've done work in Hawaii, Oregon, Colorado, where the Catholic Church was very, very deeply involved with the local police, very involved with prosecutors, very involved with city officials. And so any reporting to local authorities was pushed and, kind of buried. There's a murder case going on right now, the Fight murder case, and that happened in Texas. And that's because there's no statute of limitations for murder. That case is now finally going to trial 50 years after the murder happened. And that case was buried by local authorities. We don't see that kind of cover up anymore because of a greater separation of the church and civil authorities. So the cover up is more pernicious because you don't have that ability of collusion.
Right.
So it has to be far more insidious. And it has this kind of institutional cover up isn't unique to the Catholic Church. We see it in any kind of institution where there is secrecy, where there is a strong authority figure or a hierarchical structure that demands obedience, where you see a charismatic figure in a big someone who commands a great deal of power and respect. It may not be a religious figure, but someone who is a strong leader and very respected and admired. Any kind of institution with that kind of power and magnitude in the community. So the cover becomes far more pernicious. There's a wonderful article written by another former FBI profiler about why child predators are attracted to careers in the clergy. And it is because churches and institutions are wonderful places for predators to hide because they offer secrecy. They offer a quid pro quo on forgiveness of sins. They offer a place where people go to instill trust in families, where people think they are safe. So the cover-up is very, very pernicious.
And also where they provide authority and they provide a very strict set of rules that you must follow and you must listen to this person. And if they're higher up in the hierarchy, that their word is almost like the word of God.
Exactly. And this is the place where you baptize your child, you get married, you bury your parents, you you raise your child according to the rules, you live your life according to the rules. And when someone comes forward and says, I was sexually abused, within this amazing structure that provided me everything that I have lived my life towards, it completely destroys your entire set of values. Absolutely. And people have these blinders and they can't live outside of those blinders.
Yeah, I think at one point that it was difficult for people to actually believe. I mean, they literally could not believe that priests were capable of doing that kind of thing. Clearly, that has stopped. Clearly, no one on this planet could think that anymore, because we have tens of thousands of examples of priests doing exactly that. But what hasn't changed is the sort of blind faith and the belief that that is somebody else doing it somewhere else, not the priest that I know, not the church that I know, and where in fact those are the most dangerous ones. The people who believe that because a priest is a priest and a nice guy and a leader and a wonderful speaker and a soothing voice and a good man, that person couldn't also be sexually attracted to children. And that's the big lie. That's the absolute fallacy. The fact is that the people closest to these offenders are the ones that will be their strongest supporters, the ones that believe beyond any doubt that they are incapable of it. But again, those are exactly the people that would be in a position to take advantage of a child, because there's so much trust and love around them.
Exactly. And it's funny because I deal with that even in my own family. My husband was a converted Catholic, and the priest who helped him through his conversion before he and I knew each other, huge predator, is admitted to it, ended up having tons of victims. And he and I would have discussions, and the first thing he would say was, Joel, but he was a really good priest. No, he was not a good priest. No. He was a great speaker. He was a great, you know, this and that.
Manipulator.
He was a bad priest.
Yeah, because part of being a priest is protecting children. Part of being a priest is being moral. You can't be a good priest and be a child molester at the same time. You can appear to be a good priest. You can have the imprimatur of being a wonderful person, but you're still a very bad person and a very bad priest. But I want to talk to you about something you said a few minutes ago, until the laws change. Well, I don't think the laws have to change. 15 years ago, when I was in the course of doing a number of investigations against the Catholic Church in a number of different jurisdictions, where I was consulting with district attorney's offices in places like New York and Pennsylvania, across the country, every time they felt they hit a roadblock, every time they had subpoenas and documents were gone or documents were never produced or they were supposedly lost in a fire, what we found was that there was some kind of edict back in the day by the Catholic Church to collect all these documents and send them through diplomatic pouches to the Vatican so that they could not be attached and they could not be collected by law enforcement. To me, it was the perfect opportunity to do a RICO investigation and a RICO indictment against the Catholic Church, pierce that corporate veil, and actually get those documents. Catholic Church is not alone. Many other churches are doing this, many other organizations around the world, but the Catholic Church is the only one that has its own country. It's got diplomatic immunity. It's got the ability to hide documents and take them out of the country. Most organizations don't have that. I propose that. I found out in talking to Francie Hakes the other day that she had written a white paper for the Department of Justice saying exactly the same thing at almost the same time. And both of us were shut down unequivocally. The FBI told me I was insane. They told me there's absolutely no way you can do that. And I said, why? We all know this is a fact that they covered up for these priests for decades. Why can't we treat them like the organization that it is? What do you think about that, Joelle?
You have hit on something that we have been talking about in the movement for, you know, the 15 years I've been working in it.
Well, I wish we had known each other then.
Oh, I know. It's been crazy. We've tried it on the civil side. We've been trying with prosecutors all over the place, and no one will touch it, and it's because people consider it religious persecution. Yeah. And that's the one reason you can't, because every year The president of the United States has his great big dinner with Cardinal Dolan, and the presidential candidates have their dinners with Cardinal Dolan, and it's considered religious persecution, and we can't do it. And every time we try to pass statute of limitation reform, the Catholic conferences across the country wield tremendous power and influence.
Yeah, in Brooklyn.
And yeah, it's horrible. And unfortunately, we have a very difficult time separating for people the faith, which is, you know, the faith of my father and his family and many of my friends and the laity and this, from corrupt church officials who've covered up crimes for decades.
Right.
And that's what we need to do.
Right.
And that's what a RICO action would do. And we've been pushing for that for years. But unfortunately, politicians are very, very scared. And they think that, well, if we get a RICO action, then I'm not going to get reelected or, you know, whatever. And the evidence is there. There have been a couple of very brave civil attorneys who have gone after the Vatican in civil action. And sometimes it makes its way up. And I think there might be one or two cases still going. But it's tough. It's a tough road. It's expensive. But people are still willing to do it. And if anyone wants to do a RICO action, I'll be right there behind them with everything I've got.
Okay, well let's talk about that, because I'm serious offline. Let's talk about that, because I mean, I still feel like I should have a case against them. I investigated a number of cases in which I know the Catholic Church got rid of documents, specifically destroyed documents. And in my case, they did not have any documents that the CYO camp, the Catholic Youth Organization camp that I was molested at, and many other boys were molested at. They had no records of that camp being part of the church. I mean, it's just outrageous. And the guy who ran the camp for him was a guy who they kicked out of the seminary and was kicked out of 13 different Catholic schools over the course of 23 years. Every time there was an allegation, he was confronted, he was allowed to resign, walked down the street, found a new Catholic school to teach at, and nobody said a damn thing, a goddamn thing, and I mean it that way.
Oh, yeah. One of my closest colleagues is a guy who wrote the report in 1985 that told the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops that they were looking at $1 billion liability for child sexual abuse. He worked in the Vatican Embassy in Washington, and the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops immediately demoted him and sent him into the chaplaincy, made him an Air Force chaplain, scuttled his entire career. He's now one of the great, he's still a priest and a great advocate for victims. He's the guy who, I mean, he knows how they destroy documents, where they put the documents. It's there. And it's a tremendous thing.
It should all be in an affidavit. That should all be in an affidavit in the RICO indictment.
Yeah.
On May 18th, a news conference was held at the U.S. Bishops' Conference in Washington to provide detailed information on a three-year-long research project into the causes and context of the crisis involving the clergy sex abuse of minors. The study, commissioned by the U.S. Bishops as part of its pledge in the Charter to Protect Children and Young People, was carried out by the John Jay Institute for Criminal Justice of New York. It is a highly regarded institution that is part of the City College of New York.
So what do you think this is all about, you two? I mean, why won't they just clear the decks of all of these priests? I mean, why? What are they afraid of? Why won't they just clean house and
money, 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 money? It's all about money. It's all about exposure, and they will lose parishioners, they will lose donations, and they will lose billions of dollars.
By getting rid of these priests and not just
by admitting it, by admitting the extent of it. No, they haven't admitted the extent of it.
Well, yeah, and the guys who are the highest up, the most powerful bishops and cardinals in the world, are the guys who have done the best job at protecting these priests. And I look at it this way, you know, a guy who molests kids, and we're going to say men here, because I think women are just as, you know, they're just a bigger problem. In the Catholic Church, we're looking at men.
No, there's plenty of female teachers in the Catholic Church that are still doing it. But
In the Catholic Church, it's mostly men who are molesting kids.
Well, I don't agree. I think that back in the day when they were only men who had access to kids in the Catholic Church, but certainly in Catholic schools now, there are plenty of lay teachers, and there's no reason why they're not molesting kids.
Yes, exactly. But, I agree with you 100%.
But certainly the hierarchy of the Catholic Church is mainly male.
Yes, yes. Sorry, I didn't make myself clear.
No, that's okay.
So these molesters are broken. There's something horribly wrong with them. They need to be taken off the streets. They need to be put somewhere where they can't hurt children. Mm-hmm. The real evil in this system are the men in the hierarchy who continue to allow them to remain with children. That's the real evil here. And it's like, and when I look at, you know, so there's a case of Oliver O'Grady, who was in Northern California. There was a great documentary about him called Deliver Us From Evil. This guy was just insane. And he molested all these kids from infancy to young adulthood. And he kept trying to ask for help. He would have Sex Anonymous meetings in his church basement. He'd reach out to the bishop. He reached out to Cardinal Mahoney, all this stuff. And Cardinal Mahoney kept moving him around and moving him around and moving him around. And O'Grady should have been put in jail. And O'Grady should have been taken away. And O'Grady was mentally ill. And O'Grady should have gotten help. And he should have been kept away from children forever. But the true evil was the fact that Mahoney covered him up and lied about it and never was held accountable. Mm-hmm. And that's what really gets me about this. He's never been held accountable. He never thinks that anything he did was wrong. And he's covered up for hundreds of guys and just allow them to continue to molest kids and considers all these kids just to be disposable, doesn't care.
That's
and somewhere somewhere in the back of Oliver O'Grady's animal brain, he kind of knows what he did was wrong. But Cardinal Mahoney, he doesn't think he did anything wrong. And that's what really, really gets me. It's because, a true evil.
Because he believes that once a priest becomes ordained, that he is God, basically. And he can do whatever he wants because he's doing the work of God. And he should be allowed to do the work of God, and he should not be prevented from doing the work of God. And therefore, we're not going to let anybody play with that club that he's in. We're going to prevent people from stopping people who, once they get in this club, because they believe that this is now a emissary of God. And it's just, they won't get off that. And the fact is that they're using that as an excuse to protect the image of the church that gives them power, period. That's what they want. That's what they're doing. They're perpetuating it. They've never changed in that. And they certainly have not, Lisa, they have not opened up their books. They have not told the world what the extent of this problem is. They've admitted to a chunk of it.
Yeah.
But as you said, Joelle, it's just scratching the surface.
So, if I may, can I pivot away from the church for a moment? I mean, my family was Catholic. I'm not. So, I don't go to church. I'm not Catholic. So, am I safe? I mean, if I'm not part of this organization, and you were saying that this isn't the only organization where this happens. So, where else should I be worried if I'm...
Oh.
Well, I think it's important because we all, you know, I can imagine our listeners saying, well, I don't go to church. I don't have people in my life who are in this kind of a powerful position who could do this to me. So,
okay, well, every single youth-serving organization is a target-rich environment for those who are sexually attracted to children. They have plenty of patience, time, energy, and effort, and they will focus on trying to get access to your kids. The most important thing for you to do as a parent is to make sure that the people that you know, love, and trust do not have unfettered, alone access to your children. Make sure that you know, that your children know, that they can talk to you about sex. You have to have a dialogue back and forth. You have to be able to discuss with them the issues out there. For example, we try to protect our kids from sex and sexual victimization by keeping them naive and sheltered. It's the worst thing we can do. We don't do that, right? We don't do that when you live on a busy street. You don't protect them from the busy street by not letting them know that that's dangerous. You walk them to the corner. You tell them to look both ways. You hold their hands and you walk across with them until they can do it safely on their own. But with sex, we keep them sheltered. We don't even tell them that it's an issue. And what does that do? It makes them better victims, more vulnerable, because they want to know. They hear this concept. they have feelings about this concept, but they don't get any information from their parents.
Well, let me just tell you, I'm sorry to interrupt, but as a parent, I have to tell you that we don't all do that. I have had these conversations with my children, and it is not as easy as telling them not to cross the street. I mean,
why?
Because you could, okay.
It's easy to say, like, I started when my son was really little, and it's, you know, and you start with just with language, you know, using the proper names for their body parts.
Yes, of course.
And you start rules like, hey, you know, you don't punch the dog, and no one takes pictures of you without clothes on, and you make it very, very palatable. And it's also, and it's just as important online as offline. And so we were talking earlier before this podcast that my son had changed the password for our Skype account. Mm. Now, the thing is, all our passwords are written down, and he had written it down, and I just didn't know it. They're all written down in a place where we can all see. There's no electronics in rooms upstairs. All the electronics belong to mom. He only uses them. So you do, everything is in public common places. There's nothing is behind closed doors. And you start rules when kids are young.
Right.
And you make sure that everything is open, conversations are open. And the stuff that it makes me cringe when I think about how my parents talked about, you know, we didn't talk about sex. We didn't talk about any of that stuff. And so my body was this thing of shame, which of course made me open to abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Because my predator made my body something I could talk about. And so he got access.
So let me tell you, Jim, you know, I'm very aware of this topic because I was abused. And this is the first time my husband doesn't even know about this.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, I was repeatedly abused. And... I've never talked about this with anybody except for, you know, my therapist and just a very few select people. So I'm very aware of it, you know, in raising my children and mm-hmm. and continuing to try to have a discussion with them as they grow about your body is your own. And if somebody tries to touch you, you need to tell mommy, you know, no matter who it is. But it's not as easy as you kind of make it sound, you know, to continue that conversation because, you know, they show this about kids who are told, you know, don't take candy from strangers. And yet they'll do a test with kids and...
That's
they know it in
them,
their
right.
mind, but in the moment they forget. And so, you know, you constantly have to be warning them
I
about
it's one
specifically
part of the protection.
What they should be looking for.
Right.
So,
all right. If, for example, let's go back to the analogies, crossing the street, as soon as your kids, certainly by the time they could walk across the street, you had already had that conversation with them. If you had had the conversations, I tell parents, start talking to them while they're in the womb. Why wait? That's exactly the time when you should start. You talk to them about everything. It should just be one of the myriad things that you talk to your kids about right from the beginning. It will never change. It will never become difficult. It will make them much less afraid to talk to you because you've been talking to them and they've been allowed to talk to you about it their whole lives.
Lisa, how old are your kids?
Okay,
so here's a great tool for toddlers. So, because I do a lot of parent talks, and I always get the parents of toddlers who are like, oh, I don't know. And I always say one of the easiest things to do is don't force your toddler to hug anybody if they don't want to. Because remember when we were all kids and they would say, okay, go hug Uncle So-and-so. And Uncle So-and-so always smelled like cigars and Old Spice, and you hated it, and it was like,
that's
gross.
Old Spice.
And it told you as a little kid that you didn't have permission over your own body.
And to say no, right?
Yeah. And so what I tell parents now is, you know, so don't force your kid to hug anyone they don't want to. Instead, just say, you know, and if grandpa or uncle Old Spice wants to hug him and your kid obviously doesn't, say, you know, it's cold and flu season and little Susie just got over, you know, is also, and then uncle Old Spice will be like, oh, I don't want to get sick. So you teach them to shake hands, you teach them to do fist bumps, you teach them to be respectful and look people in the eye, and you don't force your child to give up their body boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge lesson right there. And so then your kid's like, hey, I don't have to hug anyone I don't want to. I don't have to feel uncomfortable.
Right.
Huge, great lesson right there. And a little, and you don't have to talk about sex. And it's so easy.
And so, you can also give them choices. You can say, if you don't want to hug grandma or somebody else, you can high five them. You can say goodbye. You can be very polite, and you can learn what the Japanese do and bow to them. Whatever it is, you can do that. You can institute those kinds of things. But the important thing is, the earlier you start it, you first have to take your own deep breath. You first have to be comfortable yourself with talking about it. And once you are, you can do it in a loving, trusting, supportive way that has nothing to do with fear. It has nothing to do with nastiness.
Your kid doesn't need it. My kid didn't learn about sex until he was 9 or 10, and he's still disgusted by it, and he's 11. He thinks it's disgusting, and that's what he needs to think about it. But he knows how to be empowered about his body.
I want to let the listeners know that Joelle actually has a book called The Well-Armored Child, which I just got. I haven't started reading it yet, but I'm sure it has lots and lots of advice on exactly what we're talking
about.
Tell
us about the book, Joelle.
Well, after being in the child sex abuse prevention exposure movement for as long as I had, I noticed that I'd spoken to thousands of survivors and helped them in their civil cases. And, you know, I'm not a therapist, I'm not a prosecutor, I'm not a social worker, but I noticed in every single case I worked on and every single victim that I spoke to, we all followed the exact same patterns. And there were very simple things that could have saved all of us from that initial abuse. Mm-hmm. And there were very simple things that our parents could have known, but just didn't, that could have empowered us. And I saw that as I became a parent, I was surrounded by parents who were just gripped with fear. And I realized it was just so easy to raise an empowered child that I could start my kid early in the womb, like you were talking about, just by using good language, by empowering him about his body, by teaching him great things and never talking about sex. My kid doesn't need to lose his innocence, but he doesn't need to be naive. And I wanted him to be strong and happy. And I wanted him to have a wonderful, glorious world where he can play, but not live in fear. And so I decided to write a book, and I made it age specific because I realized that, you know, no parent wants to read, you know, this whole thing. So you can rip out a chapter that's appropriate for you. And I decided at the very end to write a chapter about young adulthood and college because I'm realizing that as kids are going to college, they were raised in the past 15, 20 years to be so naive. They're going to college without any skills to handle life decisions on college campuses. Mm. And so I wrote it, and I've gotten great responses on it. It's taken a while, but now all of a sudden I'm being asked to speak all over the country to healthcare providers and first responders and everything else, because we're realizing that parents just aren't given simple tools. And I'm really proud of how it's turned out.
That's great. That's awesome. Well, thank you for doing that. And you just mentioned college and kids going to college. And, you know, of course, they're adults usually at that point, right? They're adults legally, but they're still children in a lot of ways. And you know, kids who go away to college, are usually typically the privileged kids who are a little bit more sheltered and so forth. But what I found, and I wrote an episode of Criminal Minds a couple of years ago about it called Target Rich, in the first couple of months of college, it's really the most dangerous for kids who start college because they're drinking for the first time unsupervised. They're maybe testing drugs for the first time unsupervised. And maybe they're getting involved in sexual relationships unsupervised for the first time. All those things at one time, at the same time, they're away from home for the first time. And they actually are in an environment that draws offenders. And I believe that the University of Virginia case in which one girl went missing and there were a number of issues that came up. It turns out it was a taxi driver who had been kicked out of one school because there was a rape allegation against him, and they made him leave not because of the rape allegation, but because he said it was consensual sex and it was a Christian school, so they kicked him out of school. That guy then went and took up residence outside of UVA and killed a number of college students and other women in that area. But one of the guys that came in and was seen sort of as a good Samaritan who was going to help her out, he said. He was caught on a video following her. The fact is that the guy who actually killed her was behind this Good Samaritan. He walked past this Good Samaritan while this Good Samaritan was following this girl, and then he put his arm around the girl and walked off and eventually killed that girl. I don't know that he was a Good Samaritan. I thought he might have been because he hung back in the shadows, waited for her to pass, and then followed her almost immediately after she passed by. I think he might have been another potential offender. And I think that that is the environment when you have kids who are vulnerable, whether those kids are 2 months old or 20 years old, they're still somebody's child, right? And I think they get to a position where they're basically feeling their oats for the first time. They have all these freedoms, and they may not be thinking about the people that are attracted to that environment to try to take advantage of them. So I'm glad that you included them in your book.
It's another inspiration behind it that I was given this great book, and of course I don't have it in front of me, so I don't remember the author's name. It's called Brainstorm, and it's about the teenage brain, and teenage being between like 15 and 21, and how it's a mess. It's a total mess. And so you send these kids to college, and they don't make good decisions. And so that was another reason behind it. And so sometimes these kids will put themselves into risky positions, and just like you said, with, you know, they're feeling their oats and everything else, and so their brain wiring is against them. And so if you're able to tell your kid, hey, you know what, you're going to have a good time, but even your brain is working against you, maybe even that awareness itself will make a kid say, hey, you know, maybe my mom isn't totally crazy. Maybe, you know, if I just step back and count to 10 and think, if make a different decision, and it's not just my mom being a nag, there's actually medical science behind it or something. You know, if I can just stop one kid from making one lame decision, then the book's worth it.
And I asked her, why didn't you tell us earlier? Why? You know? And her answer was to me that I used to say that anybody who tried to hurt you, I would kill them. And I shouldn't have made that statement.
She told me that.
She wouldn't say anything.
She asked a little girl, what would happen if your dad killed somebody? And they said that he would go to jail forever, never, never come out. And she said, that day I decided I could never tell anybody because she said I knew Dad would kill him.
Well, I'm looking at all the chapters, and I can't wait to get into this, because you have what is child sexual abuse, you know, how to recognize it, trusting your gut, who is a predator beyond the stereotypes, institutions and families when good people do bad things. I mean, all of these could be podcasts in themselves, but is there any
when you talk about who is a predator, I go very deeply into what Jim and I discussed before, and I talk about female predators and how they get a pass because people don't realize that, yes, women are predators and they're a real problem. And I think the whole case of Mary Kay Letourneau and Vili Folau really opened people's eyes to the fact that, yes, women can be predators.
Yeah, yet Barbara Walters called it a beautiful, wonderful romance. It just offended me so much. During the course of that show where she celebrated, I think it was their 10th anniversary, the fact is that he talked about depression and alcoholism. And he also talked about, since then, that when his daughters reached the age of 12, which is when she, Mary Kay, who was 34, I believe, at the time, and he was 12, when she started having sex with him, he realized, oh my God, like, I don't want them having sex with some older man. I don't want them being put in that situation. I think it took that long for him to realize that he was actually a victim.
Oh, yeah. And we see a lot of that with the victims. We have a big group, because I'm also very active with a group called SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. And we have a huge group of male victims who are abused by nuns. And we have the hardest time getting any attention for them because people think, oh, you know, no big deal. And we have to chart out the research. They suffer the same consequences, yes, the same depression, the same self-loathing, everything else. And people, and then we get the whole, well, isn't it hot? Aren't you hot for teacher? It's like, no, they are just as damaged and just as hurt. And so one of the big things I work really hard on is getting people to understand the severe damage that female teachers can cause male and female students they abuse.
Right.
Well, I do a whole presentation on the offender typologies, and I include all the information about female offenders, and it's just what's amazing is I think in 2014 there was close to 800 teacher offenders, and I think 65% of them were male, and so 35% of them were female teachers. And people think, well, it's a rare thing, but it's not that rare. That's in 1 year. That's in 1 year. So, you know, it's a third of that number, somewhere in the mid-200s in 1 year. And those are the reporting cases. And remember, only a small fraction of the actual cases that occur get reported. And I think even with female-on-male or female-on-female victim students, you probably have an even lower reporting rate because many of those males don't consider it victimization. They don't realize that they're being taken advantage of. And so those things go under the radar.
Or if they do, they're not taken seriously.
Yeah,
they're told that, oh, you should consider yourself lucky, or no one's going to believe you, or no one, people are going to think that, oh, it's just a rite of passage. That kind of thing.
Right.
And yeah.
And that's something that unfortunately people like Bill Maher and Saturday Night Live are perpetuating. They constantly have comedic and joke responses to cases like this. Like, what are you complaining about? You know, and Saturday Night Live has a skit that's been going on for years where it's just a guy talking about all the great nicknames they gave him because his teacher sexually victimized him.
Well, and that was even in 50 Shades of Grey. That was a part of that I don't know if you read it, but
I did not read it.
It was a little embarrassing to say that I did. Mm-hmm. But the reason that the main character became the way that he was he was sexually abused by an older woman, and he didn't consider it abuse. And I'm like, oh, God, really? So it's, you know, and it's become this pop culture book. Now, the female character in the book did consider it abuse, but it's just, the whole thing bothered me. Well, and until we see as a culture that this isn't cool, it's going to continue. But Vili Folau and Mary Kay Letourneau have split up.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what fleshes out in the next few years.
So, yeah, and if you look at the case of Chris Brown, not that this excuses his behavior, but he said, I lost my virginity at 8. Well, he didn't lose his virginity at 8. He was raped at 8. And then when he's 15, both his manager and the female security guard at his school were both giving him drugs and alcohol and having sex with him. So 3 times that we know of, he was sexually victimized. Is it any wonder that he has issues in relationships? I mean, clearly, yeah, it is terrible. But it's actually, go Google it. You'll find those 3 articles in a minute. But it's because of how they're characterized. He says, I just lost my virginity at 8. That's it. At eight. Can you imagine?
I wanted to ask, you know, a lot of listeners write to us all the time about abuse that they are experiencing, and we do try to help them. But a lot of listeners write into about abuse that they think is happening to somebody else. And I imagine it must be really hard to know what to do if you suspect that either a child that you're teaching or a neighbor's kid is being abused. And how should they approach it? Who, if they feel like they can't talk to the parents, or should they talk to the parent, or should they talk to another family member? Like, what is the approach?
If you're a teacher, you're a mandatory reporter. So if you're a teacher, a doctor, any kind of mandatory reporter, you have a protocol that you follow. And so you always follow that protocol. If you see a child being abused, a la Penn State, or if your child's being abused, you pick up the phone and you dial 911.
Yes.
Or if your child comes to you and says, Mom, so-and-so is sexually abusing, you dial 911. That's what they're there for. Don't say, should I or should, no, you dial 911 and you get it taken care of. That's what they're there for. It's an emergency. If you suspect that a neighbor child is being abused, or let's say if a friend of your kid comes to you and says, I am being sexually abused, I'm in danger, you dial 911. Mm-hmm. Anyone comes to you in danger, dial 911. If you have suspicions and you're not sure, if your kid comes to you and says, my friend so-and-so told me he's being sexually abused. If you see or suspect something in the neighborhood, all those things that keep you up at night. There's the National Child Abuse Hotline. It's fabulous. They have a website. Just look up National Child Abuse Hotline, or you pick up the phone and you dial 1-800-4-A-CHILD, number 4, letter A, CHILD, C-H-I-L-D. They have crisis counselors 24/7.
Wow.
And they will ask you questions and they will walk you through the entire process.
So this is for the U.S. We have a lot of listeners who are in the U.K. and abroad. I don't know if you have any resources for them, but if you are in the U.S., then yes, 1-800-4-A-CHILD.
Yeah, so this is the United States. Now, I know that the U.K. does have something very similar. And I'm sure that I can look that up and get something to you before this goes on air.
And for our listeners in Australia, since the recent sort of outbreak of actual reporting that's being done there, there may be something there as well.
Yeah, and I can get all that information. But and these crisis counselors will walk you through. And the thing is, never lose sleep over it. Because what could have saved me were the 20 people who knew that I was being abused and sat on their hands and didn't do anything. And all it would have taken were a couple of phone calls. And not only would they have saved me, but they would have saved the 4 other girls that he sexually abused.
Mm-hmm.
And the nice thing about these crisis hotlines is you're not calling the cops, you're calling a crisis hotline operator who will ask you a series of questions. And they'll find out where you are and the best reporting line and see what you suspect. And so that you know exactly what's going on and then the best person to report to. And so that you can sleep at night, because no community wants sexual predators roaming around. They want these problems solved. They want these predators put behind bars, and they want good questions answered. So in the United States, it's 1-800-4-CHILD, and we'll get the answers for the other countries, because every country wants these questions answered, and sometimes the police is not the best place to go.
I think I'm just going to share anecdotally that I think sometimes when parents find out this is happening, you know, they want to handle it themselves. They don't want the police involved, so they just try to, you know, take their child away from whoever's abusing them, but still keep it in the family and keep it a secret. What would you say to that approach?
When child sexual abuse is a crime of shame and secrecy, and when you keep it that crime of shame and secrecy, you deny the victim the ability to own their story. Would you keep a murder a secret to protect the other victims? Would you keep a felonious assault a secret to protect the victims? No. You never keep a violent crime a secret to protect anybody. The only person you protect is the predator. When you expose a crime, you help the victim by allowing them to own their story. You protect other people from being sexually abused. And you allow the victim access to resources for healing. You allow them to talk openly about what happened to them. You allow them to process the crime, their feelings, and to grow through the experience. When you keep a crime, when you keep child sex abuse a secret, you do not allow them to grow through that experience. You do not allow them to process it. You do not allow the family to process it. You do not allow them to become an adult through the experience. You make that crime remain a childhood, buried, horrible thing that will come out at the worst possible time. And so that secret is only going to become worse. You need to protect the victim by allowing them to own their story, by forcing people to become accountable, and by allowing everyone to grow through therapy, resources available, and by holding people accountable.
That's great. And I think that the reason why people have that sort of, I don't know, bad plan to address it is because there's so much shame associated with sex and sexual victimization. And so the way to counteract that is to speak about it. I mean, you're very brave to speak about it today. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I've been trying to speak about it. Joelle, thank you for speaking about it. I was actually told by a very prominent person who I worked with that I would embarrass the FBI if I spoke about it publicly, that I could not be an expert witness and a professional in this field and still talk about the fact that I was sexually victimized as a child. I, of course, knew that that's the exact opposite thing. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I'm a former prosecutor. I know that if you have a potential bias, you have to disclose that bias. Hiding it is what makes me incapable of being an impartial professional. If I speak out about it openly, then that gives people the opportunity to cross-examine me about it. It gives people an opportunity to understand that I'm not trying to hide it and work behind the scenes. I'm very open about it. So I knew that it was the right thing to speak out, so I did speak out. But I was just blown away. It wasn't just the guy who was my mentor. It was also the head of the Child Sex Crimes Division of the Department of Justice, who told his prosecutors, do not use me as an expert witness because I spoke out about the fact that I was a victim. So, I mean, it's just outrageous.
Yeah, it's just crazy. And I always tell people that child sexual abuse has nothing to do with sex. It's a crime of power. And the more we get that across, the more that people understand it has nothing to do with sex. It has to do with an adult having power over a child. And the more we remove sex from the equation, the more that we're able to talk about it and deal with it as a society. And it's a real crime that needs to be addressed on every level, on the civil level, on the criminal level, and even on the family level.
Well, I wanted to thank Jim very much because of his openness and honesty about his experience. You know, it really made me feel like I was in a safe place to talk about mine. Hopefully I'll continue to feel that way. But yeah. I want to, you know, Joelle has a quote at the beginning of her book that is by Brené Brown, and it's, shame derives its power from being unspeakable. So, you know, being able to speak about it to the right people is just very important. It's certainly important to me.
Okay, I would like to discuss what you just said a minute ago, because I think terminology is incredibly important, and unfortunately the English language is so malleable and is so subject to misinterpretation. But when you said that child sexual victimization has nothing to do with sex, the way I would explain that is, sex is the weapon used in this crime. It is a violent crime, but it is a sexual crime. Sex is absolutely the motivation for preferential sex offenders. Situational offenders as well, but preferential offenders, the entire motivation is them wanting to get access, authority, and control over kids so they can have sex with kids. But the fact is that sex becomes a weapon. Sex should not be a weapon in any situation, but it's weaponized by victimizing people with it. It's the same with rape crimes as well. But yeah, go ahead.
I think what this is the difference between our perspectives, because your audience, because you come from the criminal side, mm-hmm. and I'm talking to adults coming forward who are victimized as children and parents. And so I have to tell them that this has nothing to do with sex, because they're thinking, oh my God, I'm talking to adults saying, did I ask for it? Did I do something? They said I was a slut. They said I look sexy in my altar boy uniform. And I have to tell them, this has nothing to do with sex for you. Right. And so it's just a difference in our perspective.
Right.
I totally get what you're saying. And I agree with you. And I think it's just a difference in how I have to frame it for my audience.
I totally get it.
And I would just ask you, and I want to bring up a couple other terms too, but instead of saying nothing, because I don't know, I mean, people are smart enough to say, well, it did have something to do with sex because sex was involved in it. Except instead of saying it has nothing to do with sex, if you turn it into sex was just the tool that this offender used to take advantage of you, to commit a crime. It was not a sexual relationship, because it has nothing to do with sexual relationships, because they're using sex as a weapon. Right. And so I think it's, and literally, because I think, and this is one thing that Ken Lanning was very good about, he taught me about the importance of actually getting on the same page terminologically, understanding the terms that you use, because people will interpret things differently, and that's the way the English language is. There are very many different ways to interpret. There's a lot of words that mean a bunch of different things at the same time. So anyway, that's the first thing. The next thing is the term predator. And I understand. Predator is somebody who preys on somebody who's weaker and more vulnerable, who takes advantage of somebody else. I totally understand that. The problem that I have with that term is just that When you think of a predator, you think of lions and tigers and bears. Oh my, you don't think of the nicest guy in the world who lives next door to you, who, you know, does things for you and volunteers babysitting when you're in a rush. You don't think of that person. And that's the person that you're voluntarily handing your children over to. You'll never think of him as a predator. You'll never look at him when you're looking for predators to protect your kids from. So it's just a word that's so emotionally charged and so basically deceitful. If you tell a kid, watch out for predators, they're going to be looking for lions and tigers and bears. But they're not going to be looking for the nice guy or the nice teacher or the nice FBI agent on the block or cop or whatever, anybody, coach. Or they're not going to be looking for the people that they look up to and love and trust. And we need to get people to start doing that. Because if we don't look at those people, then we are not going to be able to protect our children from them.
Yeah, Joelle has a whole chapter on this in her book.
Oh, yeah, because I stranger danger doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And I go, because I had a big, so when the Catholic Church first started their whole, we're going to educate people on being safe from sex criminals. Mm-hmm. First thing they did was talk about stranger danger. And I'm like, I'm sorry, guys, that's not going to work. And that's, and that stranger danger is a big misnomer. Of course, teach your kid not to take candy from strangers. That's great. That's 5% of the battle. Our problem is the guy you already know, love, and trust, who you invite into your home every day.
Yeah, and I actually, if I can intercede there, I'm sorry. It's less than 1,000th of 1% of the battle. I mean, the estimates of children who get sexually victimized every year range from 250,000 to 1,000,000. And the children who get abducted in the United States of America per year are 160 to 200. So it's literally 1,000th of 1% or half of 1,000th of 1%.
I heard you're more likely to get struck by lightning. I heard something like that's what the statistics are. You're more likely to get struck by lightning than to be your child to be abducted by a stranger.
So we have to understand the relative importance. Sure, abduction is something we want to protect our kids from, and that is only important if they are in that situation. You still have to protect your kids from the very present danger. And the statistics now are 1 in 4 kids, male or female, 1 in 4 kids get molested. If you have, you know, a class of 40 kids, 10 of them are being molested while they're children. I mean, that's outrageous.
I recently looked at a picture of me in a class photo when I was in elementary school. And if I put a black cross over every girl's face who I knew had already been abused or who would be abused by the time she got to college, like almost every child's face, including mine, would be blacked out. I mean, it's just incredible.
It is incredible, but we don't talk about it. Well, not everybody doesn't talk about it. We're talking about it, and we're really happy that our listeners are listening, that they care enough to hear about this. It's very difficult to hear about it. It's very difficult for us to go through these topics, especially since they're so personal to us, but we have all been through it, and we all feel very much a mission to get the word out, because we know by talking about it, we're empowering people to prevent it, and that's what's most important to us. We want to prevent it from happening to other kids.
Yeah, just by opening the dialogue itself is just, it's so empowering to people, because so many people feel isolated and alone. And there, no one should be isolated and alone.
Absolutely. And there's one more term that comes up all the time that I also take issue with. And that term is my offender. And I believe that psychologically what it does is it ties a victim to that person, that criminal. And I think if you can start thinking about changing that terminology to the person who offended against me, I think that's a way to psychologically separate yourself from the guilt and the shame and the responsibility for being victimized. And so
that's huge.
I really do think so. I think it's a way to make victims realize they were not an equal part of this situation. They did not have the power and control. They did not have the authority. They did not have the wherewithal, all the means to prevent this from happening. The offender took advantage of them. The offender is outside of them. My offender is connection and ownership. And I don't think that that's psychologically helpful. It's better to keep them outside where they are and in a position of authority a position where they took advantage of you as a kid?
Well, I feel so tired right now.
Well,
that was a lot to talk about. Yeah. And Joel, oh my goodness, we could talk to you for about so many other things. You're going to have to come.
And I hope we can have you back again.
Yes, we're going to have you back anytime. And in person and all that stuff. And, you know, I know a lot of things that we've said today, because I know our listeners, they're going to be really emotional and it's going to really affect them. And just know that, you know, contact me on Facebook. You know, we will try to respond as quickly as we can, or use the phone numbers that Joelle has said if you need help or anything. You know,
call 911.
Call 911. Yeah. Speak out. You know, use your voice, because we don't want this to happen to any more people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say this, Joelle. I am so happy that you have the disposition that you have, mm-hmm. when you're dealing with this. Mm-hmm. So many victim advocates sort of carry around this sort of dark cloud of pain and suffering with them. You are thriving. Mm-hmm. What's important is that your persona, what you project, is so amazingly positive. And I love that, mm-hmm. because that's what we need. You need to be the face and the personality of the fight against this very, very bad thing. And that is child sexual victimization. And just, I feel such great energy from you. I'm overwhelmed. Thank you so much, yeah. for helping other kids that you will never know, for generations to come, they're going to be safer because of your work. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Well, life is too short to be sad. So we all need to smile a whole lot more.
Well, you do a good job. Thank you so much.
And I know that Laura really wished that she could be here and talk to you too. And I know hopefully at a future date we can make that happen.
Great.
But it was like midnight in London for her, so she had to sign off. But we will definitely have you back.
Yeah.
Great.
So thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you to our listeners for being part of this very instructive and important, though very intense, episode of Real Crime Profile. Till next time.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is, please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.